Welcome to a special edition of Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we look back on the year we've left behind.
2016, a year we won't forget.
I'm Greta Anderson.
And I'm Gail Seiler.
And you know, it's not all bad, as long as you're with friends. We talked to a lot of people on Local Talk this year, and we've shared a bit of ourselves as well. Gail and I are going to review some of the highlights with you today.
Yes, who knew you'd ever be discussing foreign policy with Madeleine Albright?
That's right. The year began with caucus fever, and in the midst of that, one day we got a call from Madeleine Albright's assistants. Of course, she was in Iowa supporting Hillary, but we happened to speak the day after the historic lifting of international sanctions against Iran.
This is what's known as Implementation Day. It's the beginning of a process in so many ways because we have to really make clear that we continue to have eyes on everything. Hillary, Secretary Clinton had said, distrust but verify. I think we really do have to verify everything. I think people need to be clear that American sanctions have not been lifted. Those sanctions have to do with the fact that Iran has supported terrorism. There are international sanctions that have been lifted, but this is the beginning of a story, and now we have to watch Iran's behavior, but it's the right step.
And this has nothing to do with the 10 sailors who were caught in Iranian waters?
No, I mean, the thing with the sailors is that the fact that we were able to get that resolved as quickly as we did, I think is a sign that it was a good idea to be dealing with Iran. That one of the problems is when you have no relations with a country at all, you have no way of changing their behavior. And Hillary was one of the, when she was secretary, as I said earlier, really began a lot of those contacts. And so the sailors, as Secretary of Defense now has said, there was some navigational issue that was the problem. And as a result of the contacts that were developed through these negotiations, I think it was possible to resolve that relatively quickly.
Okay. Well, I thank you for your time. I apologize for our frigid Iowa weather.
Yesterday, I was on the road for 12 hours. I went to Clinton and Dubuque and Acora and Waterloo and met with a lot of really motivated people that are going to go out, weather or no weather, knocking on doors and getting support. And the organization is working, and I was very, very pleased to be here and delighted to continue my travels today. Thank you so much for spending time with me, Greta.
Thank you, Madeleine. Secretary Albright.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, Greta, you're on a first-name basis with Secretary Albright now. Is that right?
You bet. And I'm on a first-name basis with Ben and Jerry, but I guess everyone is. Here's Ben, or Jerry, I can't remember, on a visit to Ames to serve ice cream to Bernie's door knockers and phone callers.
You know, Wall Street is stealing money from everybody else. You know, and a good example of how that's happening is this new flavor I came out with called Bernie's Yearning. You know, this is a participatory flavor. You take the lid off, and what you see is this huge chunk of solid chocolate that covers the entire top of the container. And beneath it is just plain mint ice cream. And that huge disc of chocolate on top represents all the wealth that's been generated since the end of the recession that's gone to the top 1%. And the way you eat it is that you take your soup spoon, which represents your caucus vote, and take it and whack that chocolate disc up into lots of little pieces, let the ice cream soften up for a bit, mix it around, and there you have it, Bernie's Yearning.
And then on caucus night, February 1st, KHOI hosted a live national broadcast, equipping lots of folks, lots of volunteers from KHOI to go out and gather audio at their local caucus sites.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's national coverage of the 2016 Iowa caucuses, and numbers coming in with about 34% of caucus locations reporting. On the Democratic side, we're looking at a 52% Hillary Clinton, 48% Bernie Sanders, and no mention in that report of Martin O'Malley. Joining us on the telephone right now is Gail Seiler, who has been covering some of the Republican caucuses. And, Gail, are you with us?
I am. I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can. Give us an update on what you're seeing there at your caucus location.
So the Republican caucuses have pretty much finished. Their voting is finished. The speeches or the presentations for each candidate are over, and people have filed out, and the counting has happened. The Democratic caucuses are still going on. You know, they use a different style of caucusing, and theirs are still going on. But I have here with me some folks who ran the 4-2 precinct caucus in Memorial Union, and they're going to talk with us. And are you a student here at ISU?
I am.
So you counted the results. First of all, how did that feel?
Well, with about 10 different cameras on your faces, it's a little pressuring. So we made sure to count them twice in front of everybody.
So let's hear the results of this precinct. Can you get into it?
Absolutely. For Bush, 3 votes. Santorum, 2. Christie, 1. Huckabee, 3. Kasich, 5. Cruz, 67. Rand Paul, 46. Carson, 31. Trump, 41. And Rubio, 115.
So there you have the results from precinct 4-2.
Okay. Well, Gail Seiler, thank you so much for joining us here on this live national coverage of the Iowa caucuses.
That was an exciting evening to be a part of. And by the way, Donald Trump did not win on that night.
2016 saw the deaths of many beloved artists and performers, too many to mention. But none of these deaths were as shocking as the loss of Prince in April.
Our station manager, Ursula Rudenberg, shared this moment from her life the day after the news broke.
I just, you know, in my mind, yesterday, all day long, I had a particular scene in my head from my own life. It's when I, in around the early 1980s, I moved to New York City and, you know, was kind of on the low end of the totem pole in terms of apartments, as one is when one moves to the city. Living in an absolutely miserable, roach-infested apartment on the Lower East Side. And I remember waking up in the morning. It was a very, very dreary environment, but it was like one of the most beautiful moments, memories of my early times in New York City. And why was that? It's because when I woke up, this is what I heard playing in the apartment next door was coming through the window. Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was When Doves Cry by Prince, who, as practically everybody knows by now, died yesterday, April 21st, in his home in Minneapolis. And the causes of death aren't really known yet, and an autopsy will be performed today to find out the cause of death. And I don't know about you, but I have not recovered yet.
And this is a special edition of Local Talk, looking back on the year we are leaving behind. I'm one of your hosts, Greta Anderson, together with my co-host, Gail Seiler.
Local Talk benefited from three wonderful journalism school interns over the summer, and we also had a standout intern, Henry Corbin of Nevada, during the spring. Henry came to us wanting to do agricultural journalism. As his last contribution, he gave us this story on poppies for Memorial Day.
When I started to write this story, I originally was only going to cover the symbolism behind the poppy as a sign of remembrance. But as I dove into this story, it developed into a larger one. Growing up in a small town, Memorial Day has always been a very visible holiday. American flags line Main Street and Lincoln Way. The small red paper flowers the American Legion hands out on the corner of Main Street. There are plenty of visual representations of it all around us, but what do they mean? What are these little red flowers, and why are they a sign for remembrance? French Flanders, a region in France home to some of the worst fighting in the First World War. During the month of May, a Canadian officer named John McCrae, after proceeding over a close friend's funeral, noticed how poppies grew on the freshly dug graves. He sat down and wrote the poem known today as In Flanders Fields. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow. Between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly. Scarce heard amid the guns below, we are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. In Flanders Fields, a poem written by Canadian soldier John McCrae on May 3, 1915. In the years since the First World War, the poppy has come to represent remembering the men and the women who lost their lives in battle. Yet the poppy wasn't always a symbol of remembrance. It was once nothing more than a weed. The plant germinates in disturbed soil. There they would grow rampant in European farmers' fields and spread like wildfire after a field was worked. This trait was how they became a symbol of the First World War. In the war-torn battlefields, ripped apart by artillery and by trenches, the poppy flourished. The flower spread, covering the once torn countryside with its vibrant red flowers. Eventually, the poem inspired another to create what we know as the remembrance poppy. In recent years, the poppy has been even adopted into the hijab. A red poppy version of it was created by British Muslim students who also wanted to use it on Remembrance Sunday, but to commemorate the 400,000 Muslim soldiers and the 1.2 million Indian soldiers who fought alongside British troops in World War I. The poppy has become known through many other countries, including Ireland, England, and throughout many of the UK, United States, and others. The white poppy is a version of the red poppy. It's been created for the Peace Pledge Union, and it is to not support any kind of war, but to remember those who did fall. The purple poppy represents animal losses in World War I. It was created in recent years to help remember those forgotten victims, the horses and many other animals used throughout the war. What amazed me when I was researching the story was how a symbol that has become so sacred came from just a simple weed. The men it came to represent had probably spent most of their lives fighting to kill it off from their farm fields. And when I thought about that, I realized how many of the soldiers fighting in that war were probably farmers themselves. Some were probably fighting in the fields they had worked.
And that was Henry Corbin, former intern at KHOI Community Radio, Today's show is a special look back on the year 2016 and the memorable moments we had on Local Talk.
At Local Talk, it has always been our policy to consider the flowers and insects and birds and mammals as members of the community we serve. This year, we had help on our wildlife coverage with regular visits by Ames resident Tyler Harms, the director of Iowa Young Birders Association, and Jennifer Knox, a Nevada poet who teamed up on a project called Iowa Bird of Mouth, which is a crowdsourced internet poem featuring a different native bird each month.
Recently, Susan Franzen hosted a show that brought Tyler and Jennifer together with Dennis Malsby, an accomplished Ames poet who we have featured on Local Talk, for a conversation whose many strands fell together in an interesting way. You will also hear the voice of KHOI host Kay Puddock.
So our first bird was the American goldfinch, and that represented the month of September. And it was the goldfinch, as everyone is very familiar, is the state bird of Iowa. But it's also a very good bird to represent September because that's often when goldfinches are starting to build their nests in Iowa. So a very appropriate bird for the month of September.
So they build their nests in the fall.
They are a late nesting species relative to the other songbirds in Iowa. And the reason for that is because they rely very heavily on thistle seeds, thistle plants. And it's in the late summer and early fall when these thistle plants start to produce their seeds, and if anybody's seen a thistle seed before, it has kind of the little feathery end to it, and they rely very heavily on those seeds, and so they're timed perfectly with the production of those seeds.
I see a little irony here, as the Iowa bird survives on Iowa noxious weed. Is that right?
That is right. There are some thistle plants that are native to the state, but most are considered noxious weeds, yes. So it's a little bit ironic indeed.
Yes. That's
opportunists.
And that was your first month. And what did you have that September, October?
So October was the ring-necked pheasant. Again, a very familiar bird in the state, a very colorful bird, very noticeable on the Iowa landscape. We often see them out roaming around on the gravel roads on the rural countryside. And ringnecked pheasants are a very important bird to Iowa economically because they're a game species. They're hunted in the state.
And that's another irony because they are not native.
Correct. That is correct. They are not native. Introduced in the early 1900s.
And actually, you sent a poem that refers to that, I believe.
I'll read it. This is a verse from Poem for the Ringneck Pheasant. The reporter stands in the hurricane chamber. This is a Category 3, he wheezes, skin pulling from his face. I am in Iowa, where there are no hurricanes, but where a windstorm brought us the ringneck pheasant. I'm waiting for a windfall of money. I don't care where it comes from, where it blows in from. Some of my neighbors say they'd never take Illinois money, but how would they know? Isn't that funny? Very fun. And we invite you to share your words on the American crow, which is this month's spotlight bird.
And at the end of this conversation, you'll hear one from Dennis Malsby, because his haiku, which won first place in the haiku division of Lyrical Iowa, is about crows.
And what a coincidence. And we have a lot of ex-Iowa Pats who have contributed to the poem, and it's their way of sharing their memories of Iowa and memories of the wildlife here. And there's something about the connection between Iowans and birds, which inspired me to create the project. So birders can contribute to this. Writers can contribute to this.
And what we've always said, too, Jennifer, is birds are everywhere.
They're everywhere.
You know, this month in particular with the American crow, I mean, it's one of the most cosmopolitan birds in North America. It's widespread from coast to coast. So, everyone gets to see an American crow.
You don't have to be from Iowa to write about crows.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So we'd like to hear Dennis's poem now.
Crows wing roll through smoke across a field of parched grass. Red-hoofed fire gallops. So any Iowans that have ever seen a farmer burning off his field or a field that's caught on fire from the spark of a tractor's exhaust, you know,
So the surprise in the last line is the fire compared to a galloping animal.
It takes you into, you have the vision of the crow wing rolling through smoke, and then you have a field of parched grass. So you've got the location and some motion, and then you get the little aha moment. It's, you know, the fire galloping across this field.
Now, I haven't seen that many fields burning. I have seen a few, but do you often see crows coming up out of the...
Occasionally you see a lot of birds that are in front of the fire because it's driving insects out.
Right.
And so they're having a good time feeding.
Oh.
Depends on the time of year. After the first frost, there aren't many insects around. But, of course, in the old days when Iowa was tall grass prairie, you had prairie fires. That was why there's no trees here. You know, the trees were burned out, but the plants that had adapted had very deep roots, and they survived the fire. And so the prairie needed the fire, or it would cease to exist. Mm-hmm. So fire is a part of Iowa's, you know, rural heritage.
Right, right. So the crows, are we meant to assume that the crows are there after the insects also?
Yeah.
Do you know what this reminds me of? I don't know if this is an irrelevant association, but in Anglo-Saxon poetry, you often hear battles, people drawing up ready for battles, and then crowds of crows gathering over the because they'd seen so many battles that they knew there were going to be dead bodies.
Yes. And crows, in fact, were one of the few flying predators or vulture-like cleanup crew that we had here in Iowa until we reintroduced the turkey buzzard. You know, and now they're getting some competition from the turkey buzzard.
You're listening to a special edition of Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That song, The Elephant and the Tiger, was written by Ames musician Brian Dudley and performed by the local group Strong Like Bear. Over this past year, we had numerous local musicians on Local Talk. Just to mention a few, Cheshire Moon, World Bank, Larry Red Stoltenberg, Dr. Murdoch, and Liana.
In 2016, social media brought to the nation's eyes many tragic murders involving police and people of color. But there was one week of violence in July that truly shook the nation. First, an unarmed man, Alton Sterling, was killed outside a convenience store in Baton Rouge. Then it was Philando Castile, killed in a routine traffic stop in Minnesota. And several days later, three police were killed in Baton Rouge.
That week, we invited in Edna Clinton and Davida Hardin of the Ames NAACP and Commander Jeff Huff of the Ames Police Force. I first asked Edna Clinton, president of the NAACP, about her feelings.
First of all, before I begin, I would like to take a moment of silence to recognize the sadness that this past week has happened around our country, for the families, for the shattered communities, for all of the individuals whose lives were relinquished much too soon. Thank you. Well, my emotions, all over the chart, is the best I can describe them. There's sadness, there's anger, there's the confusion that comes with yet again. There's the total frustration of haven't we gone down this path before? Why repeat history? What we have seen in the last several years is what I refer to as modern-day lynching, except instead of a rope, they are guns. So my emotions are just really high right now, some good ones, in terms of the fact that we here in Ames are being proactive as best that we possibly can. And sadness that we still, if you will, have the bad apples in our good barrel of apples.
Davida Harden, who works at Ames Middle School, gave this perspective.
I work in the school district, and Officer Schaefer is our SRO. I see him interacting with the students and building that relationship of trust, being that resource, not just for when things go wrong, but when things go right. I see him giving out the badges. I see him giving high fives. He check in on students. How you doing? How was your test? All those things bring me a level of comfort. And so when incidents that have happened in our country, I'm very proud to say that's not going on here in Ames. And if I could take what we have here in Ames and spread it out across the country and say, this is the way it should go, guys. This is the way it can go.
And, you know, Gail, that moment not only made me proud of Ames, it also made me grateful and proud that KHOI could be a place where these folks could come together on such an occasion and continue to build trust for one another and communicate that sense of mutual respect to our community.
The Black Lives Matter movement that arose in response to events like these certainly caused many white people to reflect on the biases that we carry. One highlight of my year here at Local Talk was an interview on the occasion of Columbus Day that also drew attention to white bias. Sometimes what happens in the studio is surprising, and some facts told to me by Bill Bigelow of Rethinking Schools and the Zinn Project were shocking, even if the news was over 500 years old. Here he describes the Taino, the people who inhabited the island of Hispaniola, where Columbus first landed.
Yeah, the Taino were the indigenous people of the Caribbean, and on the island that sort of Columbus made his base, Hispaniola, which is, you know, today the Dominican Republic and Haiti, there were at least several hundred thousand of them, and perhaps more. There are estimates anywhere from 3 to 10 million. So
Wow. There
were huge numbers of them, and they were, you know, Columbus's son, who was also Fernando, who was Columbus's biographer, says that Columbus told him that in the first 4 years between 1492 and 1496, that two-thirds of the Taínos were killed or died in various ways. And so, you know, who knows the numbers that we're talking about. Another of Columbus's biographers said that Columbus's policies toward the indigenous people in the Caribbean led to complete genocide.
And it wasn't just Columbus. It was also his men who carried out a lot of these brutal acts.
Sure, yeah. I mean, his second voyage with, you know, 17 ships and, you know, maybe 1,200 men, that was really the invasion with horses and the attack dogs and all the rest.
So how has this conventional narrative, which is so different from what you just described, been perpetuated?
Well, you know, the problem is not with what went on 500 years ago. The problem is with what children still too often learn. And they learn a narrative of whose lives matter and whose lives don't. And so, you know, Columbus, the great explorer, the white people who came, we learn their names. We don't learn the names of the people who were here. We don't learn anything about them. The most typical kind of children's book on Columbus, you know, will show, you know, that iconic picture of Columbus kneeling on the beach and planting the flag, and there are his men around him. And, you know, we'll see these sort of voiceless, Indians there, but their lives really don't matter. And what we learn about is the naming, you know, San Salvador, not being told that the place already had a name. It was called Guanahani by the Taínos who were there. And we learn kind of nothing about their lives. No, there's no curiosity. There's no question raised mm-hmm. about what right did Columbus have to do this. You know, he was coming thousands of miles from another country. And so children are just taught that this is just sort of the normal thing. This is okay. And so it really, it encourages kids implicitly to embrace colonialism, to this idea that some people in the world have the right to rule over other people. There's nothing really explicit said about that. Yeah. There's no book that I've ever read that says, well, because Columbus was white, he got to rule over. But, you know, kids are smart. They're, you know, I have a 7-year-old grandson, and they're trying to puzzle stuff out all the time. And so, you know, you can imagine, well, what distinguishes Columbus from these other people? Well, he's white, they're not. He's armed and they're not, so might makes right. Or he's Christian and they're not. Mm-hmm. Or he's coming from, you know, a more technologically developed, at least in some respects, society. So people from those kind of societies have a right to rule over others. But, you know, whatever it is, kids are being invited, urged to embrace this kind of fundamental kind of cleavage in the world between the people who have a right to make decisions, sort of the real people, and then the people who, you know, Eduardo Galeano calls los nadies, the nobodies, the people who have no rights.
And that was Bill Bigelow of Rethinking Schools and the Zinn Project. You're listening to a special edition of Local Talk, looking back at audio highlights of the year we've just left behind.
The year 2016 also gave us a number of weather events. Our station manager, Ursula, was present for the most serious of them in September. She delivered this radio essay on her experience.
I was standing in my father's kitchen on Thursday night, talking on my cell phone and eating a piece of fruit during the thunderstorm, when there was this enormous thunder crash that felt, well, personal, and everything went white around me. The piece of fruit flew out of my hand, and the doorbell started ringing and kept ringing. I smelled burning electronics, so I followed my nose into the living room and discovered that the television was dead, completely dead, and I picked up the landline phones, and they were all making kind of a horrible noise and were also dead, and the air conditioner had stopped, and the electric car door would not work. I felt pretty sure our house was hit, probably through the TV antenna. So I ended up thinking a lot about lightning, and I looked around and talked to some people about lightning and have learned a few things since then about it. It's one of those things that happens and seems to come from the heavens, literally, and yet what are the ground rules here? So, or what are the grounding rules here? So here is a random collection of information about lightning that I gathered during the past few days in no particularly scientific order. First of all, it actually is questionable whether Ben Franklin's kite-flying expedition with lightning actually happened, or if it had the results in discovering the nature of electricity. Skeptics point to the lack of hard evidence backing his version of the experiment, and it's not even really been possible to duplicate what he did. And there were no witnesses and only vague accounts from Franklin himself. Speaking of myths, lightning strikes many places, apparently. It is not true that it never strikes the same spot twice. In fact, the Empire State Building in New York is struck by lightning on the average of 23 times each year and was once struck 8 times in a row in 24 minutes. About 70% of lightning occurs on land in the tropics, where the majority of thunderstorms occur. The North and South Poles have the fewest lightning strikes. Over 1,000 people get struck by lightning every year in the United States, and over 100 of them die as a result of the strike. Yes, it is very deadly, as we all know. And lying flat on the ground was once thought to be the best thing to do if caught in a lightning storm outside. But this is actually also a myth, because when a lightning bolt hits the ground, its current fans out from the strike center in a tendril pattern, and it can be fatal up to 100 feet away from the point of strike. So in order to maintain your chance of not getting struck or being struck as little as possible, you have to minimize both your height and your body contact with the Earth's surface. However, if you're camping or away from the house for other reasons, or if you're an animal in the wild, it is best to stay away from hilltops, tall objects like isolated trees, and it is best to stay in low areas or ravines. And of course, Always stay away from water or metal objects, which will attract and conduct electricity for long distances. However, lightning can reach you indoors as well, especially if you're in contact with the telephone or plumbing. Plumbing because it's connected to metal. If lightning strikes the phone line outside your house, the strike will travel to every phone on the line and potentially to you if you are holding the phone. So if you are indoors during a lightning storm, stay off of the phone if it's a landline. About 4 to 5% of people struck by lightning are struck while talking on a corded phone. If you must call someone, use the cordless or cell phone, and that way you're not in contact with any wires that run outdoors. Surge protectors don't protect against lightning strikes, so try to unplug devices like televisions, computers, and anything else attached to a cord. So use a cell phone during a thunderstorm and stay away from indoor plumbing and metal window and door frames, which are also lightning conductors. Now, back to my dad's house. He does not think that lightning hit our house. He says two things happen with electricity. My father's a scientist. One is an electric current with mass, for instance, lightning hitting the TV antenna directly. And the other is electric field, which has no mass but lots of energy. He claims that lay people highly underestimate the energy field aspect of electricity, and he claims that I assume our house was hit because, like most people, I do underestimate the power of the electric field, which means that lightning hit near our house, and I just experienced white light and all, the field, which, by the way, has enough energy to fry the TV, fry the thermostats for the air conditioning, fry the electric garage door, the phones, and to ring the doorbell. It's just showing off there. As for the food that flew out of my hand, he thinks that was just me being so surprised by all of this. He does not think the electricity lifted the food out of my hand. I still think it does. Moral of the story for him, electric fields are important and should not be overlooked. Moral of the story for me is do not talk on a landline in an electric storm and unplug all your electric devices.
A week or so after the storm, our regular guest, Emergency Management Coordinator of Story County, Keith Morgan, came on the show. Keith's guest was Ames Police Chief Chuck Sykosh, who described the situation from his perspective.
Well, it was kind of a difficult storm. We were at the center of this series of thunderstorms that Keith described, and this storm just kept raining on Ames, and so we did not experience the river flooding that we're accustomed to, but what we did experience is this flash flooding where our roadways turned into rivers themselves. And so we had roadways with 2 and 3 feet of water running down them, and it just really challenged the capacity of the storm sewer system. Certainly across the community we had people who had basements affected. We had a couple of basements that got a lot of water in them, and we had one basement wall collapse, and so the fire crews were pretty busy with those. And then we had so many disabled vehicles and stranded motorists across town. We had 2 shifts of police officers in trying to make sure those folks were out of danger. We weren't necessarily able to get all of the cars out during the storm, but we got the people out of danger. And so we had 2 shifts of police officers. We had fire crews out. We had electric crews in. We had water people monitoring the storm. And that was all working fairly well, but we were getting close to the edge where we might need some extra help. And that's when we invited Keith and the city manager and some of our other emergency operations center down to help us monitor this thing and just see if we were going to ride it out or have more damage across the city.
Of course, the real groundswell we saw this year reached its high water mark on November 8th, when disgruntled Iowans cast their ballots for Donald Trump, hoping to make America great again.
The result was a Republican landslide in Iowa, as in many other states. We were on the air the next morning and spoke by phone with Laura Bellin of Bleeding Heartland political blog. Here's what she described as the likely consequences of the Republicans now controlling both houses of the legislature as well as the governor's seat.
I think we'll see less funding for public education than we've ever seen before. I think we'll see a dismantling of some social safety net programs in Iowa. I expect the preschool program for four-year-olds may be at risk. I think collective bargaining rights for public employees are probably going to be on the chopping block. That's been part of the Republican playbook in states like Wisconsin as soon as they had control of all branches of government. I would expect some kind of restrictions on voting. I don't know whether they would eliminate same-day voter registration, but I certainly think that voter ID laws or other rules that are designed to suppress the vote are going to be on the table. I would not be surprised to see restrictions on abortion. There have been some restrictions that passed the lower chamber of the Iowa House and were stopped in the Iowa Senate, so at this point they have a clear path to do that. Certainly gun law is going to be changed. I would expect stand your ground legislation to pass, possibly also open carry legislation or doing away with the permitting process for concealed weapons.
I suppose technically that list should be part of our 2017 show, not our 2016 show.
Let's hope not, Gail.
We'll see.
But our consolation on that day, December 9th, was the presence of a couple of talented young people who have shows here on KHOI. Here's 16-year-old Lucas Bliley of Ames offering his perspective.
I think, first off, everybody needs to accept the results of the election. This was democracy, and the people elected Donald Trump. And that's a reality we have to live with. That being said, I think if you are in a place such as Ames where there are a lot of minority groups and you're friends with a lot of minority groups, reach out to them, talk to them. If they're being mistreated by a new piece of legislation that we see in the near future, just be there for them. You might not be able to change anything politically. But you can be there to make things better just in terms of moral support.
The Dakota Access Pipeline, or Bakken Pipeline as it is variously called, was another major story on local talk this year. I recall many memorable interviews of Iowans fighting to protect Iowa's rivers and their farmland, commercial crude oil pipeline. And also interviews of Iowans traveling to Standing Rock Reservation in Cannonball, North Dakota, to stand in solidarity with the Lakota people fighting the same battle. I myself had the opportunity to interview two elders of the Cheyenne River Sioux at the Ocheti Sakawing camp. But you and I were both here, Gail, for hands down the most dramatic moment in this story thus far, when we spoke to Boone resident Mark Edwards, our regular correspondent on all things pipeline-related, who had witnessed the announcement at the Standing Rock camp of the Army Corps of Engineers' early December decision to deny a permit for the company to dig under the Missouri River.
His description of the wave of sound by which the news traveled down the hill at the camp is an image that really remains with me.
I think the official count was well into 11,000 people there yesterday. We had a nice weekend, sunny, warm. Things were going really well. And then you couldn't quite make out exactly what people were saying quite up front, but you could kind of hear a little bit that it was a big announcement. And as that happened, this wave of sound rolled down the topography. This is kind of a rolling hill valley, and it just, that's what I remember, is just the sound. It was like water rolling down the hill as that whooping and hollering and yelling just transformed the whole place. I think that was the shock. As I said, you know, we're in a militarized zone. It was shocking to me of all the military and helicopters constantly and that kinds of things. And so when that hit, it just broke the reality we were in. And from there on, you know, you couldn't make sense of it again. I mean, there was jubilation, but there was people crying. There was people going, oh, this, you can't trust them. I mean, there was every array of reaction to that, things like that. So people are going to wait around to see about that January 1st when we have a new president. People are somewhat skeptical, as they have, you know, should be after many years of not trusting the government to do the right thing.
You're listening to a special edition of Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, looking back on the highlights of the year we have left behind. Many count that moment in December as one of the few victories of 2016, uneasy as it may be.
And, of course, the daily victories of a life well-lived are what many of us hold on to. One of our favorite moments from 2016 was Kay Puttick's visit to the Mucky Duck, a British-style pub in Ames that last year opened its outdoor patio to customers' dogs. Here's Kay Puttick on that beat.
Is that a Newfoundland?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, my yeah. God, it's a gorgeous dog.
Yeah, they are lovely.
Let's try to get some shade for the big boy.
She's a girl.
She's a girl. Then petite.
She's very petite for her size. Yeah, this is a shady spot here, and we can definitely, maybe I can put up another umbrella right there and angle it so we can get a little bit more shade for her, okay?
Oh, super, thank you.
Do you guys need a drink machine? Will you find yourself
Well, I see you've got your dog here on the patio.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, I'm with KHOI Radio. It's the local community radio station.
Well, it's nice to meet you. We're from New Jersey. This is Ellie. And we're taking her on a road trip for a month, and we're glad to find this place to eat and hang out. We're very grateful.
Right, yes. When you've got a dog on the road, they love to get out of the car.
Yes.
So you're very glad to see this place.
And they're super friendly and welcoming, and it's great.
So you've been here before?
No, we've never. We just landed in Iowa today.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, we left New Jersey on Wednesday.
Well, we just came by on the off chance with our dog in case there was someone here I could talk to. And just then you were arriving, so that was handy.
You've got a wonderful dog, a really wonderful dog. So do you live here?
Yes.
So do you eat here frequently with your dog?
I don't think Marcus has had this open for the dogs, but I eat here frequently. Yeah, I like it. Since I'm British in origin anyway. So
how long have you been here?
Oh, since 1968. A long time. I see you brought your dog here to the Mucky Duck patio. Have you been here before?
Oh, yes, many times.
Okay. So it's a big attraction for you having the patio where you can bring a dog, is it?
This is the first time he's been here, but I've been here many times, yes.
Oh, okay. So he's getting kind of excited because he sees a couple of other dogs here.
Yeah. He will calm down a bit.
he could probably walk over and greet my dog, actually.
That one is yours.
Mine's the big Newfie
the big
there.
Newfie? Awesome.
Shall I take him over then?
You sure can.
Well, the two dogs greeted one another. The third dog is a little shy of other dogs, so didn't greet him. Okay. Do you like the food here?
I do, very much. I'm especially a big fan of the fish and chips.
Well, Gail, we're almost done with 2016. One other landmark event of this year was the retirement of Vic Moss as the director of the homeless shelter after 29 years of service to the community.
I've heard so much about him.
And rightly so. He set the tone for so much of the caring community here in Ames. I was lucky to have the chance to ask him about his early days before he started working at the shelter and when he first took the directorship there and lived with his family in the shelter. This excerpt from a much longer interview had many surprising moments for me, but will give our listeners a sense of the man.
I was going to be a wildlife biologist and got pretty close to having that finished. And then the Vietnam War was there, and it just seemed like I wanted to do something that I considered relevant. And even though I didn't feel like I was a natural for being involved with a lot of other people, I really like my time alone, and that's why a biologist seemed like a pretty nice career. But I thought sometimes you should go against type, and I decided I'm going to try this. I had some curiosity about just what happens, you know, why growing up schoolmates in a town that had some major economic problems where a huge railroad had pulled out and taken about half the good jobs, and I saw a lot of things fall apart, and kids I'd grown up with getting in trouble, and yet some of these kids were I considered best friends. That I just kind of wondered what's happening. You know, we all grew up in the same community, but I had no grasp at all what was happening in these lives. And so anyway, that was just kind of that curiosity that led me to social work.
And what was your first job out of college then?
I got a job working for Iowa Department of Human Services in Story County. And I did that for 3 years. And during that time, there was a huge increase in the awareness of child abuse. It was a phenomenon which actually didn't exist. There weren't even laws protecting children in many states. In fact, some of the early cases were actually prosecuted using cruelty to animals rules because children were considered property of their parents. They were called their chattel. And parents could basically do anything they wanted to. There were high-profile cases in the Des Moines Register of children that were killed. And so the state just decreed that we have to do something. So they named me the child abuse investigator for Story County. With very little training, I had to go to a lot of conferences and read and stuff like that. But it really was a new field. And before I knew anything, I had 40-something cases with very few prospects of having much of an effect on these families. And that's when I started discovering some of the underlying issues behind other social problems. It's hard to imagine anything that doesn't happen to children. I mean, I've dealt with children blind from being shaken, children that, you know, with broken limbs that were never set, with burns. I had some of the worst cases that a judge said, he said it was the worst he'd ever seen. This is a veteran judge in Iowa. And I realized that this isn't doing it. You know, for one thing, we have to look at risk factors and try to determine what could happen earlier on before these cases happen. And I discovered that stress in the household was one of maybe the biggest risk factor for child abuse to occur. And the biggest sources of stress were economic stress. These are usually families living in poverty. The American Humane Association says it's about 20 times as likely to happen in a household with poverty. That figure might be a little high, but it might not, because that was a predominant risk factor that I saw. Mm-hmm. And I realized that the solutions lay in looking at the broader issues of poverty.
That was Vic Moss, who retired last year after 29 years of service to the Ames community.
Thank you, Vic. And that's it for 2016. You've been listening to a special edition of Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Gail Seiler.
Many thanks to our other Local Talk team members, Susan Franzen, Ursula Rudenberg, and Kay Puttick, for their input into this show.
And thanks again to our wonderful intern, Henry Corbin of Nevada.
Local Talk was engineered by Greta Anderson. Our theme song was Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Other music we heard was Prince, When Doves Cry, Strong Like Bear, doing The Elephant and the Tiger, and The Beatles with Martha, My Dear. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show or any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org.
Putting this show together, we wanted to air highlights of Local Talk in 2016, but it was difficult. There were so many good segments to choose from. It made us realize the depth and breadth of topics that we bring to the listeners. And we know that our listeners appreciate it. They've shown their support in our recent fund drive. We surpassed our goal of $25,000, raising over $30,000 and getting over 50 new memberships. So we want to say thank you to you, our loyal listeners. We're proud to have your support, and we'll continue to bring you an array of interesting, touching, and sometimes provocative shows on Local Talk, because that's what we do here at KHOI. But it's only possible through your support. So thanks for listening. Happy New Year, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Thanks so much, Gail.
Thanks, Greta. It was fun putting this together. I hope our audience enjoys it.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.